You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact? You can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to Stuart Laws, one of the senior Stuarts in comedy and a man of many hats. Stuart is not simply a sort of absurdist lunatic of a comedian who appears to be a normal person and then very slowly draws you in to a really frothy and daft world full of kind of microscopic connections and all sorts of stuff. So he's not only that, and indeed he's also not only the person behind Grave New World, currently available on Amazon Prime, a COVID-themed or indeed recovery, post-COVID-themed sitcom slash sketch show. So not only, we're still on not only's, but also a man who created, co-created Turtle Canyon Production Company when he was only 18, a slip of a lad, and who now has gone on to direct, I mean, absurdly enormous and impressive catalogue of shows for other comedians, including James Acaster's repertoire on Netflix. He's directed Joel Dommett. We'll talk about those a little bit in the Insiders Club extras. But also, I mean, he's so busy getting things done. I'm very pleased to have had time to talk to him. I also highly recommend following him on TikTok. You can find that in the show notes via his link tree, because he does wonderful, wonderful little daft micro sketches. He's basically working at an incredible rate and enormously impressive, and also quite a humble, private, quiet kind of guy. So with all that in mind, let us welcome, after this brief rejoinder to join the Insiders Club to get hold of 25 minutes worth of extras from Stu and everyone else who's been on the show recently that we've had extras, including the audio from the Insiders-only Zoom Q&As that we've had recently with Alfie Brown, Nish Kumar, James Acaster's done two now, one in November and one earlier this year, and Fern Brady is doing one. That's coming up soon, so you can get invited to that as well. All of that at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Now, that's all the ado. This is Stuart Laws. I can't remember when I last saw you live. It will have been at Edinburgh in kind of 2015, 16, I think, but that seems a million years ago. And I kind of, like, it didn't take long in the show before I get in the groove of going, oh, yes, this is what Stu does. Because you have this lovely kind of pile up all of these absurd ideas and then they sort of spill over and then there are like multiple kind of structural callbacks and ideas of, do you know what I mean? It's just like, it's a real feast of absurdity. And I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
I was properly laughing out loud in the car, which is always a good thing for me. And then I saw, and it sounds like I'm going to say, and then I saw Grave New World, and I hate it. That's not what I'm going to say at all. But I saw Grave New World, which is your series recently released on Amazon Prime, very recently released,
yeah, yeah. I think,
last couple of weeks. And It's in four episodes, but it's not. It's an hour.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's an hour just like one of your stand-up shows. And I was watching it. The first one I found, I'm not going to say mystifying, but I was like, what kind of thing is this? Is it a bit like Brass Eye? Is it a bit like something else? Is it a bit, you know what I mean? It's like a sort of a host doing stuff instead of a magazine program. And it was only really by the middle of the second one I went, oh, this is a Stuart Laws hour, whereby all of these stupid things are recurring multiply within it and like a great big, do you know what I mean? It's like a big fountain of absurdity that somehow loops back onto itself.
I like that a lot. Thank you.
Good. Discuss. Is that right? I think there's even a joke halfway through Brave New World where you're talking about, where you as the host are talking about how it's only been cut up into four because it makes it easier to sell.
Yeah, yeah. There's that. Obviously, there's that meta part. It was originally a 53-minute show and it started life as a potential live show. I was like trying to work out what I was going to do with all these ideas I had about life after a pandemic that were a little bit skewed. So it's like going to the cinema and it turns into a weird conspiracy thriller sort of thing that I had written. And then as I was writing it, I was like, this doesn't feel like a live show. And I'd spoken to some people about maybe streaming something and didn't feel right. And then was like, I think it might be that I've written a TV show. And then I just immediately started booking in people. So I got Alex Keeley and Eleanor Morton. They script edited it and they sort of came in and sort of told me where I'd gone, you know, completely off chart, off reservation. Okay. And then just started booking in cast. And then was like, as it was being filmed, I was like, I think I know what this is more and more. And that's what happens with my live shows as well. I think, in fact, Alex Keeley has said to me, he's seen my show late July, previewed with me, and thought, to say to me, you should get rid of this little bit, and then seen it 3 weeks later at the end of Edinburgh and being like, oh no, that was the crucial bit of the entire show.
Why is that? Why do you think, like, why would he make that error about it? Is it because
he's
the
thick.
What turns out is what you're suggesting is that what turns out to be crucial is sort of deeply buried? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, I think so I try and find the show, and the same with Brave New World, and the same with my previous show, Stuart Laws Is All In, which I haven't got a recording of, so you haven't seen. But like, okay, that was all about choices. It was all about choices that you make in your life. So I wrote all the routines out. They were like based around binary choices. I still didn't find exactly what the whole sort of mechanism which it oriented around until very late. And I think it's because I've got all the ideas, and so every little bit of material fits all of that. But until I find that final device, so the one that you saw, Stuart Laws Stops, was about fridging, the concept of killing off a female character to give the male lead greater emotional depth. And it wasn't until, I think, even the second week of Edinburgh that I finally realized how I needed to tell that story and sort of rejigged it all. So all the lines all mean something. It's just I haven't quite found how to express it well enough yet for it to make sense.
Okay. And with that show that was about fridging, is it simply about the, when you say it's about fridging, is it that you've noticed that's a concept and you want to write something about it? Or is it like a personal story about loss that then wears the clothes of something about a kind of pop culture trope?
Well, that show started from a cynical place, which is something I don't think is a good place to write from, is that I just noticed a lot of stand-up shows that were fairly on the rails, building towards an emotional climax sort of thing, and just thought there was something cynical about that. And so I doubled down on the cynicism and went, well, I'll just write one of those, but I'll twist it and I'll find a way. And I think it was based around the idea that I thought it would be funny to write a Shaggy Dog story about trying to put a USB in the right way up first time, somehow leading it, like that being the big emotional twist of this big Shaggy Dog story about losing the love of my life. And then everything sort of built from that. So I don't think that's a good place to write from, to be like, I'm going, there's this type of show that exists that I don't like, and therefore I'm going to write a parody of it. I think that's not a cool thing to do. But hopefully it's genuine. Like my mum, when she saw it, she came out, and so the show is all about a woman called Alice who I met in a bakeria when I bought a Belgian bun and then forgot to take it with me and then had to go back. And it's about how we spent our lives together, and then I kill her off at the end in this big emotional thing. My mum was like, so Alice, who's that then? And I was like, no, it's nobody. It's literally nobody. She's called Alice because I do a bit about Idris Elba in it. And Idris Elba in Luther says, Alice, and it was a chance to just do that.
Okay. And with those, just on not liking those shows on rails, and maybe I'm thinking this because, and we will get onto this a lot, because you are the sort of person who, when you have an idea for a show, you have the resources and the understanding and the experience to go, oh, maybe this is a TV show. I'll make that then.
Yeah.
In a way that most people can't just decide to make a TV show.
Yeah.
Because you've had your own TV production company for a long time. We'll get into all of that.
Yeah.
Maybe it's because of that that I kind of want to talk about this element of it. But when you say that you see shows on rails which are like fulfilling, you know, the 40-minute lull and all those kind of tropes of an hour-long comedy show, it reminds me a little bit of Adventures in the Screen Trade by William, and I never know if it's Goldman or Golding.
Oh, Guy who wrote
Marathon Man and Princess Bride.
Goldman.
Do you know? Is it? It is definitely Goldman.
Golding
is Lord of the Flies. Thank you. Okay. So William Goldman, Adventure in the Screen Trade. Have you read that?
I have not, no. But I've little bits of it here and there, yeah.
I can't recommend it enough. It's really interesting and analytical and also unputdownable and funny and easy to read. And all the things I like. It's easy. But he talks about the beats of a story and why when you see a movie and you come away going, that just doesn't work, it's because they've got the beats... They've got the beats wrong.
Mm.
They've got the, you know what I mean? There is effectively what he's sort of suggesting is that there is a structure that works and it's up to the creator to do something new with that structure that works.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering if that is applicable to Edinburgh shows when we, you know, make fun of shows which build towards an inescapable conclusion or have a 40-minute lull or whatever else those tropes are, whether... You know, there are incredibly successful shows that employ those rhythms and those beats. And I just wonder whether... I don't know quite what my question is, but do you see what I mean? Like, whether there is simply... Like, whether it is naive of us all to go, oh, God, it's just another one of those, where that is actually the form.
Yeah, I think me criticizing myself for making that cynical choice, I don't have a problem with the form. And I think, you know, there's people out there who do incredible versions that do follow that form. And like, for example, Kieran Hodgson's show Maestro does follow that form, but it's like amazing. And like, there's a bit at the end where he talks really openly about this amazing thing in his life. And I won't spoil it, but like, I was watching it thinking I could never do this. Because I don't have that level of vulnerability sort of on stage, that ability to open myself up in this way, which was so naked. But like, I loved it and I thought it was amazing. And so it's not that the issue with it is when it's done and you feel like it's being done in lieu of good comedy.
Yeah, sure.
It's being done. It's like, right, well, I can't do this, so I'm just going to follow this sort of like production pack of how to do a show. And I think this will get me that, you know, fifth star or that fourth star or whatever. And that's why I don't like Lost in Translation as a film, is I can feel the reach that's happening, the cynicism to it. And
I've seen that film, but I don't remember it so well.
Yeah.
Like, what was the, what specifically?
It feels like it thinks it's a work of art.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't like that sort of vibe to something. And I'm not saying that that's what happens in stand-up, but like, I feel like sometimes there's like a cheapness sometimes of just turning to those devices when we all use those devices, but when it's like, oh, right, you haven't earned this, Bart. You haven't written 45 minutes of amazing, brilliant comedy and performed it amazingly. You've done a bit, and it's fine, and it's nice, and it's enjoyable. But then now you're trying to twist my brain into crying. What are you doing this for?
Yeah. Do you think, like, as a thing that I often, a hurdle I often have to overcome is the
the desire to have a clever ending to a show.
Mm.
Like, not necessarily even an emotional one. That's a hurdle I have to overcome as well. Like, for some reason, I think it was maybe a lot of us that sort of grew up as comics watching Kitson do shows where you go, I'm laughing the entire time and now I'm feeling really hard. You know what I mean? Those kind of things. There have been numerous kind of Kitson copyists over the years, and people who've either tried to do that as well and not done it as well, or people who tried to sort of cynically, you know, lift the format and paper over the cracks of their own narrative, what have you. But one of the things I always want to do is have a big emotional moment. And one of the things I always want to do is have a big, clever reveal. So with your fridging one, you know, it does. I wonder if you have a sort of a liking for those kind of, like, the way it always makes me think of Christopher Nolan. Like, when you watch Memento and you're like, well, this, I'm loving this. This is great.
Yeah.
This is thrilling. This is exciting. This is intriguing. Oh, and look at the end. All the bits fit together. God, that was clever. And it gave me just enough of the information to be able to get there myself a second before it confirmed it. So now I feel really clever and I can kind of roll around in it and congratulating myself.
Yeah. Go on. The Nolan thing is particularly relevant because The Prestige is how I structure all my shows, and when I direct people, is what I talk about. So The Prestige opens with Michael Caine explaining what The Prestige is. So he talks about the structure of a magic trick. And then he shows you a magic trick, which is a bird disappearing. Mm-hmm. And then reveals the truth of it is that one of the birds died. And a kid says, yeah, but what about its brother? And so, like, basically in 2 minutes, the film explains to you what the rest of the film is going to be. And if you're paying attention, you'll be like, oh, that's the film. This was what. But then over the next 2 hours, it then does that, but slower. And then you get to the end and you're like, oh, yeah, that was. I mean, I only found that out of watching like 4 or 5 times and being like, that's what they're doing.
Yeah, sure.
And so that's the start of my shows. And like with Stops, the beginning of it, I explain what fridging is.
Yeah.
And I explain what Edinburgh shows, what fringe shows are, and how they're designed to have this big emotional ending. And so I give all that information. I try to work in a few jokes early on that sum up the show as a whole, so that then the rest of the show I can just sort of take my time. And then literally, I mean, in Stops, what I realized I had to do about a week into Edinburgh was every now and then stop and say, anyway, back to the story about the love of my life, because I was trying to disguise it so much before that. And I'd done all my previews to people who are really like comedy literate and who knew me and were like, oh, we see what he's trying to do. And then a week of Edinburgh going disastrously badly, I was like, why is this not working? And it was like, oh, because I haven't given enough information. And that's what Nolan does really well, is he gives you all the information you need so that you feel clever when you work it out.
That's really interesting. I mean, it is. Here's a separate tangent.
Mm.
Do you remember? You had a bit about That's a Gibbon.
Yeah.
And I tweeted something about a joke. I saw a gibbon in a zoo, and I said, "That's a gibbon."
Yeah.
And then like 4 people commented, "That's Stuart Lord's got a whole bit about that." There are several bits of your oeuvre, and I've been watching loads of your stuff on TikTok as well, which I've really enjoyed. We'll get into that. But when you did a recent TikTok video of someone, you know, when a trailer says "forget everything you know,"
yeah,
and you forget what your hands are and start screaming, you know, crying, very, very funny. Those kind of bits, like, you more so than anyone, I find myself going, I've had that idea, or like, you know, oh, you like making Nolan type stuff. I like making Nolan type stuff. And I suppose if I've got a question about that. Other than just,
I have access to your Google Docs, and I see it, and I go, I'll get in there before he puts it out.
Well, I wonder the extent to which we are, if I say similarly mediocre white men, is that putting a negative slant on it? Too negative a slant. I wonder the extent to which you feel you are a product of the culture around you.
Mm.
To what extent is your, like, you have this amazing ability to kind of, you tickle the audience, right? Your show structurally tickles the audience. There are jokes on top of jokes. One of the reviews for it said, oh, you know, in terms of gag density, this is just off the scale. And it was so weird because I read that before I watched Stops. And I've seen you live a bunch of times. And I thought, I don't have you pegged as a kind of gag density guy. And I don't know if they mean gag density so much as laugh density.
Mm.
Because watching the show, it's just, it's funny, 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 funny. And that, like, I'm patting myself on the back now for coming up with the phrase, your show structurally tickles people. I mean, you have this great ability to kind of like get a, like whip them up into a rolling laugh with the stuff you do where you forget how to pronounce words.
Mm.
You know, and I was watching that the first time thinking, well, that's daft. It's making me laugh, but it's daft. And then by the time I saw the foyer bit on Grave New World, I genuinely started questioning myself, how is that word pronounced? So why am I saying all this? Because I wonder, to what extent do you think you as a kind of person in and maker of culture have a unique take on things? And to what extent is it the form in which that take takes place is your trademark?
I'm not sure I have a unique take, but what I hope... I remember James saying to me years ago, the thing is...
This is the band James.
Yeah, the band James. Acaster said to me years ago was, the thing is, Stuart, you're an observational comedian who doesn't understand what you're observing. And so, like, my observation, it goes off into a, it's like, I've observed that initial thing, like how you can't turn around after bowling a strike and not look smug or, you know, something like that. But then it goes off in, like, into my own little weird world. And so when he said that to me, I was like, oh, right. I didn't realize that that's what I was. And then suddenly it becomes like, oh, great. So all of my shows now are like slow burns to sort of drag people in. And they can start, you know, I do use this a similar structure. And I guess Grave New World is similar in that regard, which is a load of quick fire, shorter jokes at the start to sort of drag people in and be like, yeah, he's got the chops to do this. And then it slowly gives way to longer and longer stories, which then all tie together, and you realize that those jokes at the start actually did have a relevance to stuff that were going on, even though they're just one-liners from the start. So I guess that's what the tickling is just to be like, come on, it's okay. It's all right. Come this way. Here's some observations that you'll recognize. And now we're just going to go a little bit deeper in and we're going to do some weird stuff with it. Does that answer the question in any way?
So this is Stuart, Stew, Stewie. So weird. I love it. I love it when I meet another Stew. I wouldn't say we were prized or precious, but it's sufficiently rare that when I meet someone else called Stuart, we look at each other like, yeah, great times. So what a lovely man he is. And I mean, God, so much going on in this. What are we talking about? We're going to talk about kind of privacy and how Stuart is sort of shocked by the openness of most comedians, which is something that rarely occurs to me because we're so used to, I think a lot of us are used to this idea of comedians as people who bare their souls, who kind of disembowel themselves. Wasn't that a quote about Simon Amstel, as close to a man ritually disemboweling himself on stage, just sort of sharing everything? And so we'll get into the fact that Stuart does not feel compelled to do that and yet has a rich comic landscape within his work, which isn't mining his own sort of real experiences. But in some ways it is. So we'll get into all of that. And we will find out, and this is good. This is good. We'll find out what makes comics attractive to him as assets from the point of view of being a producer. So if you're interested in finding out the sorts of things you should be doing if you want to catch the eye of someone who works in comedy production, then Stuart is a really good person to listen to on that subject. Loads of stuff in the extras as well, including his battle to win over Henry Widdicombe, comedy's main tastemaker, and also some stuff on Natterjack Toad and listener questions about why he wears gilets. And honestly, I cannot recommend enough that you watch Grave New World and that you watch his special on Next Up Stops, because it will genuinely have you wondering about how you pronounce words that you know perfectly well how to pronounce. And if that is not a legacy, Legacy? I'm not going to get into it now. Let's get back to this conversation with Stuart Laws after I implore you one more time to get hold of the extra content available to you and everyone else in the Insiders Club at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Let's get back to Stu.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
To come back to the tickling, I don't think it is. You do shorter jokes at the beginning, sure, but it's the fact of it's the silliness, the daftness, the absurdity. Do you know what I mean? It's like a really, like, to call it, you know, whimsy is kind of, do you know what I mean, after Josie Long was really, really successful and inspired other people do things that weren't as good as Josie, whimsy became a very devalued kind of negative term, you know. But It is really whimsical, and it's really, like, I think that's a really interesting observation. You do observations, but from the point of view of someone who doesn't understand what they're observing. Like, are there other things you identify as being kind of key principles like that of the way you do stand up?
I mean, aside from the always trying to find a word that I'm going to mispronounce in a funny way and just lay that down as canon, as like, this is it now, so you have to accept it, or like, you know, calling my granddad my nandad, just not really explaining it, just being like, and you'll see that in some shows, some people just being like, you have silence of people being like, what the hell is he doing? And some people immediately being like, ha, 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 I love this. So I'll have those, but like, I feel like it's like in stops, there's like, I want to have some threads running through it that don't detract in any way from the show. So if you don't get it, it's not like you've sat through a bit that's alienating. But like, if you do clue in on that level, then it sort of elevates the whole show. So in stops, there's that thread that I am friends with S Club 7. And all the way through, as linking devices, because I have like a thing about people saying things like anyway, or, you know, those sort of like cliched, and I know they're useful, but like, so I was like, I'm going to go through S Club 7 lyrics and use lyrics from S Club 7 as my linking devices. And that means that like about 35, 40 minutes in, people are starting to be like, he keeps saying S Club lyrics. And then there's that routine about seeing five adults in a car and how upsetting that was, and then going to the funeral and having a conversation with those adults in the car, and it turns out they're all people from S Club. And just those elements where, like, if you're watching that routine, you're just like, oh, Stuart's got a friend called Tina and Joe and Rachel. but if you are a fan of S Club 7 and you've been paying attention to that, it suddenly elevates that. So it's, it's like layering a joke on top of a joke, so that there's two levels that you can be enjoying it in, I think, if that doesn't sound too pretentious.
Yeah. and do you, when you write that stuff, like, can you improvise that kind of density, or does it have to be written, or does it have to be improvised to end up in those kind of...
I think I found a lot of things through improvising it on stage and going on and being like, have this bit of a routine, how does that tie in? And then it's like the S Club 7 thing was Annie McGrath saying to me, surely you've got to make those names the S Club 7 names, because I had the whole bit of going to the funeral and having too many people in the car. And she was like, why don't you just say that they're, you know, I was using different names. She was like, and I was like, at that point, I was like, it's too late for me to get my head around this, but I'll try. And then suddenly it was like, oh, it's all tied together. So it's.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that's an interesting thing sometimes. And you found it because you've, with my 2015 show, you were the one that was like the bowling and turning around, and there's only one way to do, to bowl a strike, then turn around. You were like, we'd previewed together, and you're like, is that good? You could turn around and be Ted Danson there, based on another routine in my show about the ghost of Ted Danson.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so I was like, oh, yeah, yeah, that is obvious. It's been there and it's staring me in the face, but I haven't seen it. And sometimes it does take that sort of collaborative sort of thing. And like, that was such a fun, like, prestige at the end of that show to turn around and then secretly slip a Ted Danson mask onto my face.
No, as soon as you said the word mask, now I remember that bit and the conversation that we had about it. Until then, I was like, one of the great things about having as bad a memory as mine is occasionally being reminded of a nice thing you did or a great idea. Yeah, that's completely out of your head. As soon as you said mask, I was like, no, I absolutely remember that now. So okay, so sort of layering and kind of like collaging stuff together.
Mm.
With stuff like that, Does that come at the expense of deep and meaningful stuff? Or are you, like, is there a part of you as a comic who is on a kind of personal quest to express a thing? Do you know what I mean? There's lots of different types of comedy, and you know, I hope I'm not asking that in a way that says, go on, prove that you mean something. But, you know, there's a million different ways to do stand-up.
Yeah, yeah.
We see a lot more, I suppose I wonder, was it more in vogue years ago that people would just, you know, Milton Jones and Tim Vine and Harry Hill are kind of similar eras, I guess. It's just jokes. It's just daft, fun jokes.
And Harry Hill, I loved.
Was
my, him and Vic and Bob were absolutely the people I loved seeing.
Yeah, 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 for sure. Great. I mean, sad news for Tim Vine.
Oh yeah. Well, no, they're very fun. And I genuinely.
I'm just being a dick. I love it when people pick one name. I go, well, them. I'm just being a dick. Okay. So there were those kind of like out and out joke stuff, and now maybe it is in line with the nature whereby people like to reveal themselves on social media, you know, or maybe the social media thing is simply reflective of the trend at the moment, which is all about yourself and your journey and your struggle and that kind of stuff. Do you have any desire to, or do you ever go towards that sort of stuff, that kind of territory in your shows? Or is it for you purely an opportunity to be silly?
I think number one, it's just to be silly and see what I can get away with. I think that's funny to sort of see what path I can lead the audience down and how far they'll come with me. I like that. And I like doing as many stupid things as possible. That's sort of number one. And that's sort of why I started doing it. And when I found my voice, that was what appealed to me. But I've definitely, I'd say stops wasn't really an expression of anything particular. But there are, like, Stuart Laws is All In, which was my most recent show. It was very much about a binary choices and things like that in my life. And it ended with a routine about me getting a vasectomy. And part of it, and the routine that the show is supposed to be building up to, is me being in Vegas with my friends a decade ago and my friend losing loads of money, and then us going to a poker tournament and me and him getting onto the final table, and me knowing I had him beat, but he had lost so much money and I had lied to him to get him to go to Vegas. So I had a decision to make. Do I fold and let him win, or do I go all in and beat him? And then I go all in and beat him because he's a worm. But that is all. And then, but like that, I guess was the whole show was literally about the issue of having kids, which has had like a effect on my personal life, and that's what that show was largely built around. And, you know, I've been in relationships that have ended because we wanted different things, and that those sort of adult grown-up decisions were are being expressed in that show. They're just not being vocalized. They're being the thematically vocalized, but not in as many words.
And did those? Do you write the show, which is about silliness and is based on impulse of finding things funny, and then afterwards or mid-process kind of step outside and go, oh, that's what's really going on here?
Yeah,
or
sometimes,
do you think,
yeah,
I've got to definitely. Get this off my chest?
And Ben Targe has previously expressed to me what my show was about after I had finished it, and I'd been like, oh.
Can you come in a little earlier in the process? Then?
Yeah. which is interesting. And my 2016 show, Stuart Law, so preoccupied with whether or not he thought he could, he didn't stop to think whether he should, was about going back to my hometown in Iceland, which is just some more Stuart Law's bullshit. I see Stuart Law is back on his bullshit. but was about going back to the Puffin Sanctuary that I worked in for a summer, and turns out that my boss had passed away, and he was someone that I always really respected because he just didn't care what anyone thought, and he was like all of these sort of things, and it was like I had like deified him in my mind, but then going to the funeral and finding out that no one was actually there because he didn't have any friends and he'd pushed everyone away and things like that was an expression of like my dad, who had done the same sort of thing. And when he passed away, there were people there, and obviously it's a dramatic license, but like there were a lot of people who had had tough relationships with him. So that was a way of expressing that without actually saying out loud, it is a dead dad show.
Did you only notice that afterwards? Like, how can you no, only that notice one, that afterwards when Ben told you?
There was another thread in that, which is about my twin brother, who was a psychopath, and about our fractious relationship. And the twist at the end is maybe I'm the psychopath, with a visual joke happening. And I think Ben had been like, I think that show is about you and whether or not you think your decision making about relationships and kids and everything is psychopathic, or you know, what level of you're dealing with like these personal issues, basically.
Okay. So yeah, so my question is meaningless because there is more to it than that. I was just thinking, how could you write a show in which someone dies and the funeral comes up without feeling like maybe this is reflecting a funeral that I've been through?
Yeah, I don't know if people did, to be honest, because it was so hidden behind, like he was my boss at a Puffin Sanctuary who...
Yeah.
who, I can't remember a lot of the details, but like, yeah, he was such an asshole in it and was a dickhead throughout. But I use that as a way of like, you know, and we all do it, is sometimes you're like, well, that joke wouldn't work from my voice, so I'm going to assign it to a character within this show. And that way I can say, in fact, in Stuart Law's Is All In, I talk about someone wanting to stop at the next service station because he's absolutely busting for a cum. Now, I felt like that was not a thing that people would watch and be like, oh, I'd feel like people would watch and be like, they'd be uncomfortable if Stuart Law's on stage was saying that. But I just was so amused by the idea of someone busting for a cum that I then just put it into the mouth of my friend who was half a real person who I did go to Vegas with, but also a completely fictionalized thing designed to be this a vehicle for binary choices and things we do in our life. But there was so much in that show that I got rid of early on when I was like, this is what the show's about. It's about this part in my life when I did this and this part. And then obviously all of that was going through. So when I was like, oh, it's actually about this, then because I didn't get the vasectomy until about a month before Edinburgh. And it wasn't like, oh, I'm definitely, that's what the show's building to. It was like, even after I had it, I wasn't like, oh, I'll be talking about this on stage, because I don't do that really. I don't talk about personal stuff. And I even say that in the show where like, this is the big ending and I don't normally talk about, although there's a lot going on in that show actually. It's too, because Steve Dunn directed it and we had an evening together where we plotted out how to do a magic trick within it there is a trick in it basically that ties it all together. And it was a really fun evening of like drawing lines between things and working out how it all fits together.
Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned there that you don't get too personal in your shows.
Mm.
And that isn't something that you have to do. Like, comics don't have to be personal. But is there, I wonder if I'm sort of picking up on a kind of a reluctance to get too personal in your shows.
Yeah, definitely. There is an element of that. And that's just sort of, I sort of feel quite private person and I've always felt like that. And so when I want to talk about stuff, I want to make sure that it's in that as controlled an environment as possible. And to me, hiding it behind a few layers of absolute stupidity is a fun way of doing that, because I'm sort of getting out there, but then at the same time, no one's afterwards coming up to me like, are you okay? Because I would hate to have those conversations.
I mean, it's very hard now for my next question not to be, are you okay? I mean, do you, like, as in that it pertains to your work, what, I'm just interested. I don't know what the right question is. I'm not asking, are you okay? Are you okay?
Yeah, I'm fine, thank you.
Okay. But I'm interested because that's quite an unusual characteristic for a comedian these days, to be private. Is it? Well, maybe it's not. I suppose we all mediate the ways in which we allow people in. But most people love talking about their trauma. Most comics love exercising and expressing one's trauma.
Yeah.
By getting it out on stage and getting a reaction of some sort, be that sort of cathartic or applause or kind of sharing the burden of how much they've been hurt and those kind of things. That's far more common. And I wonder why for you the, like, you have a, like, maybe you have a kind of a tighter grip on that.
I am shocked sometimes by the level of openness that is expressed online. And I don't necessarily have a problem with it, because that would be weird. That's somebody else's feed. That's somebody else's life. That's for them to make the choices on. And I'm sure that someone, if they wanted to, could probably screenshot something and then do a this you question mark, you know, suspicious emoji. Because I have talked about various things. It tends to normally be on a podcast or in an interview or something where it's like, well, this is what this is for. And I feel like stand up for me is definitely way more just getting up and being silly. And, you know, I enjoy it. And as a kid growing up, I was always so quiet and so shy. And whenever I was funny, it felt good, but like, and it didn't make, it made people want to be friends with me, but not to be like, what, let's ask some deep questions to him. It was just like, I was like, oh, Stuart's a funny guy, so he's part of this gang, he'll say something funny every now and then and he'll be quiet for the next half hour. And I sort of quite like that dynamic,
because do you like that dynamic because it doesn't put pressure on you?
Yeah, I think so. I went to a stag do once. We're in like deepest, brightest Wales, with my friend who I write comedy with and do various things. He's the voice of the horse in the TikTok video where I call a horse.
Oh yeah, I wondered who that was. Do I know him?
You don't. He's in Grave New World. He's the couch to 5K, 5K
oh, gotcha.
To couch guy.
He's very funny. I didn't recognize that. It's a very funny bit.
So we used to do, you know, we used to like host talent shows together in our youth club and things like that. We both went there. We had to get there late. So we both drove up together and we got there and it was basically some of the quietest people ever. And we walked in and genuinely everyone was quiet, just sat in this cottage in Wales, quiet. And we walked in and suddenly everyone looked to us to be like, guys, you've got some heavy lifting to do here. And it was very much like the funny boys are here and they need to lead this conversation. And it was the most intense, tiring weekend I've ever had. And it was like, this is not, and my friend Matt, he is an extrovert and he loves all of that. But even he was like, what? was going on there? Why do we have to lead that so much? And like, they're all lovely people, but it was like, suddenly it was like a collection of people who weren't used to sort of talking and being loud and having a good, I don't know what it was. And it was, yeah, that's not for me, I think, to have to dominate and lead things.
Interesting. Oh my God. And is that part of, because you occupy a quite unusual position in comedy in that you are a comedy producer as well as a comic. And so it's interesting when you said you and your friend, you ran a talent contest. The story most associated with comics on this podcast or any podcast is like, I entered a talent contest.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm just interested in how you kind of positioned yourself. Do you know what I mean? You ran a talent contest. Obviously, I think often people who are on the other side of the camera, my guess, having not spoken to that many of them or not specialised in that, my guess is that people on the other side of the camera have a more, I always think of puppeteers. Like, all the puppeteers I know are lovely, quiet, shy people who get a creative outlet whilst no one has to look at them. Do you know what I mean? And that's part of why, I don't mean puppeteers like Nina Conti. I mean like, like, you know, whatever, Bunraku puppets.
Jim Henson?
James Henson. Yeah. So I wonder if it's something similar with you, that you're kind of shy, like the way that you have configured your career is such that you get to be private in two ways. You get to be relatively private, as comics go, by doing daft, absurd stuff in which yourself is kind of heavily protected under all these, you know, you talked about layers. That's one of the things, is obfuscation, isn't it? You're sort of like, you don't need to take responsibility. If someone goes, oh God, is he all right? They might the next minute think, or have I misunderstood? Or is this actually that croissant? Do you know what I mean? Like, it enables you to kind of protect yourself in a kind of way. And maybe there's a parallel there to you being a comedy producer and videographer and director. They also enable you to express funny ideas, but without having to be there with people checking if you're okay.
It allows me to have my cake and grieve it.
That's all we got time for. There's no way I'm doing any more after that.
Definitely. And like, I've produced and directed like countless stand-up specials, so like almost all of the original batch of Next Up specials were produced and directed by me and Turtle Canyon and the wonderful team we have, and we're very lucky to have built up a huge talented sort of roster of people who work on these shows with us. And then obviously Acaster's Netflix specials I produced, and his most recent one I produced, and Ed Gamble's Prime I directed, and Tom Allen, Joel Dommett's, Dar O'Brien's. This is a big list of people, and like, I love doing that and sort of bringing those to screen as well as we can. And there is something quite nice about that, to sort of be able to be like, you know, people won't know unless they watch the credits, and no one watches the credits. So there's something quite nice about all these people who I, you know, admire, but I'm also good friends with, to be a part of their story, sort of thing. And actually, let's not forget the elephant in the room, Stuart Goldsmith. On the first day of the World Cup, 2018, a very, very hot day, I remember.
I would not have ever remembered that as the first day of the World Cup, but we're not that similar, you and I.
it is really nice, and I like being part of it. I really like directing shows. I really like seeing someone change and sort of evolve and develop as a comedian or a performer. I really like that. And like, I worked with Harriet Kemsley in 2015, and she had a tough year because it was her debut and there was a lot of expectation on her. But like, I felt like the work that we did was helpful and helped setting a base for her to develop with. And she's worked with various directors over the years. And I think she's, you know, one of my favorite comedians. And actually she did that, her show, how have I forgotten what it's called? Whatever her most recent show is, was amazing. And it's the only time I've ever cried in a show. And I know part of that was probably because I know her, but like the mastery that she had to sort of do that and to immediately make you laugh within seconds of making you cry, and it to not be like, it's time for you to cry now, was like this is great, because this is what comedy is about. Comedy is not about just making you cry and wallow in that. It's about making you laugh, number one. But then number two, if you're going to tackle these issues, it's to tackle them with a levity to it that does leave something with people, but not in like a heavy way. So you can go away and feel like, oh, I've sort of felt something there about something, but I've laughed about it, and I feel like that you take that with you better than leaving a show in like a real deep sense of morose or whatever. Yeah. I like creating stuff. I always felt like collaboration is absolutely what's great about comedy, and, you know, talking about you coming up with that topper for my entire show, I was like, that's amazing. I could, you know, it's exciting when things like that happen and when you can contribute that to other people's shows. And I know that there's people out there who have got jokes that when they tell them and it gets a big laugh, it kills them inside because they know that I came up with it.
the sweetest feeling it is possible to achieve in comedy. A combination of success as a laugh and another comic's pain. Mwah! Oh, it's wonderful. Are you happy with the level of success you've achieved as a comic?
I'd like to be doing more TV stuff of me, or radio stuff. I'd like that. But like, I'm also extremely happy with everything that I put out, and I feel like I got an audience and can, you know, like Grave New World. I can make something like Grave New World. And the original plan was potentially that we would shop it around and see if like the BBC were interested in just buying it as a whole. And after about a week of sort of putting stuff together for that, I was just like, no, because then there's going to be so many discussions about which bits to cut out and how to reshape it and all of that, that it's going to take so much time that I won't be able to get this thing out. And so then when we started exploring other ways to get it out and Prime became an option, it was like, well, then that's better, because we can retain, as you know, having this production company means that we can retain that creative control over it. Even though it's, you know, it's, well, oh, so this production company is sort of in charge. Yeah, yeah. Who's in charge of the production company? You don't need to know.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It is interesting, that aspect of it, because I meant to ask you about, like, you know, the journey of getting a show made is so different now that I don't understand very much about getting shows made.
Mm.
But it seems incredible to me. It's like one of those people, if you meet someone who can code, you're like, oh, you're, from my perspective, you're a wizard, because you can make a thing happen in a way that I simply can't get.
Yeah, yeah. Here.
And I think you have a certain kind of wizard level understanding of, well, what do you need to do to make a show? Like, you've been inside the process so many times of going, you get this, you point it there, you get that, you put it there, you understand how to make a decision about the grading of the color on a thing. I mean, I'm basically, I'll pause here. I'm trying not to mention Louis C.K. because the obvious parallel for me is a thing that I heard years ago when he was saying, you know, everyone's coming to me saying, oh, how do we get the Louis C.K. deal? And they're saying, you can't have the Louis C.K. deal because you can't physically take a show from idea to handing in the whatever. I don't even know the format you hand it in.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, you hand in that thing. Like, I can do that all myself. Mm. And you're in a position to kind of do that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in that position because Nick and Al, who run Turtle Canyon with me, and then the, you know, long list of people who have worked for Turtle Canyon over the years. And we've worked out all these amazing people who are really talented and do various things, who now, if I say, hey, I want to film this thing, I can pay you your mileage and that. Would you be up for doing this? And if you're not up for it, we're just trying this thing out, then it's not in any way going to affect us hiring you for all of the other stuff you do, because you're amazing. And I'm only asking you because you're a talented person. I'd like, you know, and people generally are like, yeah, well, let's just try it out, see what happens, knowing that we pay them pretty well for loads and loads of things, and we will pay them for these things if it comes off. So people are prepared to, and that, I feel very lucky that I've got a team of people that will do that. And there's some people that absolutely can't commit to doing helping out on a thing because, you know, they need to pay their wages, they need to pay their bills and things like that. And, you know, we've built up such a good relationship with these people that it means that I can make Grave New World, which in reality should cost 40 to 60 grand to make, and I can make it for very, very little compared to that, maybe a couple of grand. And, you know, people are coming in and doing stuff and I'm paying them for it, but not a huge amount. And we can then get it out there and hopefully create something off of the back of that. And I think, like, for me, I treated Grave New World as like an Edinburgh show, in that you'd spend however much on going to Edinburgh and doing a show. And because Edinburgh wasn't happening, it was like, well, let's put my money and focus into this. And luckily, you know, you do an advert that gets picked up to be shown in various European countries. And so you get a sudden boost of money and you're like, well, perfect. I can pay certain things now to make this happen. And that, I feel like we set up this company with that express purpose of making corporates and things like that to then reinvest that money into our own creative projects. And we've built up the infrastructure and an office and a team of people who are excited to make stuff. And that's why we all do it. And that's why we do stand up, because we're excited to get up there and do comedy. That, we've somehow kept that sort of teenage enthusiasm going, and the company is sort of built and now is, you know, 75-80% comedy, which compared to 5 years ago when it was like 10% comedy is, you know, exciting.
Yeah. Okay. And I mean, that's fascinating. I felt I could talk lots about that because I'm just in, like, I never knew that was the journey of it. You started Turtle Canyon with your co-creators really young.
Yeah. You, so like, me and Al, we were 18 when we started. And then when we met Nick at Pinewood, we had moved into Pinewood, and then we'd lost a couple of clients and we were like basically on the verge of shutting it all up. And then Al's dad said, you need to buy a coffee machine and you need to just speak to people on the site and you just invite them over. You say, I'll have a coffee at our office. Come over, say hello. And we did that. And then we met Nick, and then we met somebody else. And that person was like, why don't you three form a company and you'll be in my post-production house. And so then Turtle Canyon was officially formed. And then it sort of just kept growing from there. There's been some scary moments. Normally when a client goes out of business and owes us a lot of money and we have to sort of, we've already paid everyone.
Yeah.
But we've sort of managed.
Does that happen often? You've mentioned that. Is if that's happened more than once?
I'd say that over the last 12 years, there's like 100 grand that we've never got hold of that we should have.
Oh my God.
Bit of fun, isn't it?
And you, it's interesting with you as a producer, you are wearing kind of numerous hats. There's you the comic and you the producer. And I suppose, given that we have the opportunity to talk to you wearing your producer hat, what sorts of things do comics do? Because I think production can seem very opaque to comics. What sorts of things do comics do that make them attractive propositions to you as a producer? Like, why do you contact the people you contact?
Yeah, that's interesting. In 2012 was when we sort of set up the YouTube channel for Turtle Canyon Comedy. And it was when I said to Al and Nick, I'd like to form almost an official wing to Turtle Canyon Media that's comedy focused. And I want to make stuff because, you know, we were making stuff, but we just had no like central place to put it. So it would be like dotted around. And so then it was like, well, I'm going to work with people that I have gigged with and really like. I think as it's grown and, you know, there's so many things on our YouTube channel now that have like led to other things, like us making Sweet Home Kettering with James led to us working on Hypothetical, doing the VTs on Hypothetical. And it's sort of, and, you know, I've worked on various pilots that have got nowhere off the back of things that have we've made. So like for us, when I'm like approaching someone, like, have you got something? Or someone's approaching us with like, here's something. It's like, do I connect with that comic brain do I feel like they've got that some that vision of like creating something very like personal to them, that it, rather than like here's a generic thing that I think would go viral or like will mass market appeal. Like that's, and I feel like most of the comics that we've got stuff when we worked with does seem to appeal, does have that sort of thing. They're like quite esoteric comics who somehow have managed to make that work as sort of a broader thing. And then when it comes to actually the making of it, it's that feeling like there's a lack of preciousness to it, but also at the same time, a real care about the final thing, if that makes sense. It's like they want to explore that collaboration of what the show could be, but at the same time stick by certain things so they don't want a certain, to push it in a certain direction. So you can explore all these different ideas and it feels open and it feels good and collaborative, but there are like full stops to it where like, no, it can't go in that direction because that's not right.
Mm.
And I think it's also the job of a producer or a director or commissioner or whatever to recognize that that is a thing that people should be able to say and should be able to stick up for their thing and come back and be like, yep, all right, fair enough, that I think you're right and you've expressed that in a way that makes me understand it. I don't know if that answers it at all.
Yeah, I think so. It's really interesting. I'm just kind of like, from a comedy perspective, I like to ask people, what went right and what's gone wrong.
Yeah.
And I'm interested in a kind of from a production perspective as well. Can you think of, I suppose, what's the equivalent question from a production perspective, specifically as it pertains to comedy? Do you ever feel that you've ruined someone's joke? Do you ever feel like you've made a bad production decision that you would look back and think, I either didn't get the most out of that person or I squashed something?
I think there's probably are definitely examples of that. Trying to think, like, the thing with Turtle Canyon Comedy's YouTube is that we often are making something that is potentially experimental or is an expression of an idea of a comic and is deliberately being made because we want to work with that person. And so we're not tying it down hugely. So sometimes if it's not quite, what it should be, is because we've taken a risk more than we've squashed something and messed it up. So we've taken the risk and it hasn't quite paid off. It hasn't quite worked properly. And I think that's the bigger fail area, maybe. But again, those are the risks that I want to be taking. And also, like, you start making something, you don't know what it is, and then you find it in the making of it. I quite like that. I'm trying to think any wrong. I mean, there were times when directing a live show when Harriet was like, no, I'm not gonna do that anymore, because that bit that you keep trying to make me do, because it's wrong and it doesn't feel right. And it was just that, I think maybe I had, that was 5-6 years ago now, and so I've sort of maybe I've learned and developed and got better at sort of understanding that relationship with a performer and a writer and their way of working. But I'm also a big believer in breaking something to try and find a fresh way of looking at it. And so maybe me for trying to force Harriet to do this routine that I thought would definitely work off the back of another routine, but that pigheadedness from me led to her sort of building a better confidence in other bits or in what her voice was.
Okay. And in terms of your own excuse me, in terms of your own creativity as a comic and as a producer, what sorts of things do you struggle with? Like, I feel like I know a good bit about your kind of comic strengths, but what are some of the things that you wish you had more of? Or
I think finding finding that like connection straight away with an audience is something that it takes quite a while for me to get. So I will be trying to win over an audience with personality for a long time in the creation of a show. I feel like it does take me a while, and I don't know if I have any like. I know I've got some bits that I can just go and do in front of any audience and they'll be like, yeah, yeah, great stuff, lovely. But like, I feel like over the course of, well, 7 solo shows now, that I haven't got those tight mainstream bits that will work and be like, oh, that's the bit that we put on TV. And maybe that's, yeah. And it's definitely a conversation I've had with my agent quite a few times of like, well, let's create those bits. And I think my last show was like, a part of it was like, let's just write routines. And, you know, because we'd come up with a couple, and then eventually it diverts into me swallowing a Kinder egg and me deciding whether the surgeon goes in through my butt or through my mouth. And it's like, okay, well, I've ruined it again. You've ruined the act, Job.
It's funny because being the producer of this podcast has given me a whole new understanding of the industry. It's let me sort of step back from it and see a little bit more of the choices. I mean, I say an understanding, my own one. It's not like there's some big secret I've become privy to.
No, there is, but we don't let people know.
Oh, we won't tell anyone. it's certainly informed some of my assumptions.
Yeah.
if I can just kind of caveat that any further. Do you think that your... that understanding how the industry works from the inside production as well as the sort of outside performance, do you think that has given you a different view or a more kind of holistic view of your place in the firmament, or maybe your lack of place in the kind of the mainstream TV stuff? Do you think the things that you think about yourself, that stuff that you've just said about, like, you know, the positioning? I always remember... I don't obviously remember because I can't remember. You got to begin a thing with I always remember and then forget the person. Who said, and on what format? Was it on one of the many, many episodes of this podcast, or simply a conversation in a pub talking about the order in which people sit on Buzzcocks? The beardy weirdo always goes on the left.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There's like there's an overview of the places at the table and who fits them.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like one of those trial shows where you go, you know, there's a bunch of comics and it's for a TV show and you're all going up and doing your 5 minutes to an audience of people who've got free tickets and don't know what it is. There was Rob Orton and Pat Cahill also on my night. And I was like, right, okay, so I've got to be better than them basically and hope they make a choice in that direction for the show. Because it's slightly alt, but not fully alt guy doing stand-up. So it was like, right, well, that's... And I don't think any of us ended up on the show, on that particular show.
Okay.
So it was obviously they just went, well, we won't have one of those on this one. Or none of them were funny enough to fill that particular slot. And I remember talking to Jason Dawson, who is a producer, and... I remember talking to him after that and I was like, well, I chose not to do this routine because it's quite long. It's actually about 5 minutes. And I thought I should just do a bunch of quicker routines just to show that, you know, I've got them. And he was like, well, weirdly, maybe a whole 5 minutes that was about that one thing might have been the thing that made the producers go for you. Because it was like, oh, he's got that thing, and that's how it can be packaged on online when it goes on social media and things like that. So, yeah, I definitely think there is an awareness of those the positions where you are in comedy, but frequently conversations with my agent will be like, how do we get them to just take that risk with you that first time, because that's all that's needed for that first one to go, oh, and he can do it, and fine, he's on there, so let's get going. And so, you know, you put together, like, I don't know, if you how to do these or whatever, where you like before doing going in to do the trial night, obviously it's changed because of the pandemic, but you'll write up a document or like your writing packet or whatever of like, here's what my routines would be for this particular show. And you write that up and you're like, right, so it's got appeal to, I mean, what do I have that appeals to? I don't have a unique selling point apart from the vasectomy maybe. So then it's like, well, how do I find something that does connect? Because what, I'm going to do a routine about bowling. Does that hold up? Does that connect with everyone? Definitely not anymore. Mm. And so, yeah, trying to find what your unique selling point is. And maybe is that what comedy has become a bit more on TV, of being like, well, that comic's that one, does that particular thing. And so it's trying, I don't know what mine is on that regard, because basically my whole thing is to slowly take you on a journey until you look back and you don't recognize where you are anymore.
Yeah.
And that doesn't necessarily work as well in short bursts.
So have you been active in trying to, or does it interest you to be active in trying to change that, to make it more palatable? Or is it the case that actually you're really happy doing what you're doing?
Oh, I'm really happy with doing what I'm doing. And I'm absolutely delighted with sort of what I'm getting to make. And I'm, Grave New World, my new show, which is on Zoom, which is Single Father of None, is like, I'm so excited because there's loads of cool elements to it that I'm like so proud of. Yeah. But there's a part of me that's like, well, I could get more people to watch those things if I was on TV and doing those little bits. But aside from that, like, it's such a weird position where I can make something with Turtle Canyon and put that out, or but at the same time I've got like a radio show that's in being pitched at the moment with a different company with me as an individual. So it's like a weird, like, and I've got a sitcom script that's doing the rounds at the moment from me as an individual, not connected to Turtle Canyon. So it's like, and Holly, my agent, is constantly having these sort of like, yes, but is this you or is this Turtle Canyon? Or is this?
Yeah, sure.
So it's finding those things, because, I would like to keep stepping further away from just Turtle Canyon. And I feel like if I can make it bigger as a stand-up, then I can help Turtle Canyon go up. And at the same time, Turtle Canyon can go up and I can come up with it, and creating this sort of conglomerate?
Yes.
A conglomerate of Stuart.
So that was Stuart Laws. Now, it's only just occurred to me that you might well be able to hear cartoons on in the background because my children are behind me. My day has slipped and eroded all of the plans that I had while they were out. And due to resolving a technical thing, which I won't bore you with, I'm now recording this while they're at home listening to cartoons behind me. And if it's driving you mad because you can't quite hear it, the voice I suspect you can hear is Brad Pitt as Metro Man in the movie Megamind. That is a glimpse behind the podcaster's bricks, as opposed to up the wizard's sleeve, which I've always thought sounds awful. I've got bundles of stuff on, and I suppose I should talk to you about it. I know it's been a couple of weeks off, but I will tell you why it's been a couple of weeks off in the postamble. For now, that was Stu. Thanks to him for coming along. Great stuff at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Thanks to everyone that's joined the insiders recently. Why don't we do one of those little rundowns of everyone that's joined recently? Hello to Kirsty, Richard, James, Julie, Chris, Siobhan, Kit, Mark, Oliver, Sean, Lily, Dan, Stephen, Catriona, or possibly Catriona. It's spelt Catriona, but who knows? Stuart, Richard/Rick, and Leah, who very kindly gifted Rick a birthday gift of a subscription. So thank you to all of those of you who've been joining the Insiders Club in the last month or two. Great to have you on board. Some of you will have received a special little secret welcome messages, so well done if you're one of them. And apologies to one or two of you who missed out. I've been having trouble with my email client, and this is the most boring thing a podcaster could possibly talk about, so forget that. But
we really enjoyed. We did an Insiders Only Q&A with Alfie Brown, and it was fantastic. Really, really good fun. And we've had superb ones with Acaster and with Nish Kumar, all now available on the Insiders feed, the private podcast. There's one coming up with Fern Brady on the 24th of May, so you have until then to join the Insiders. But I would implore you, if you are planning to join the Insiders Club just to be part of that and then leave, you might as well wham up your the single month you're planning to pay. You might as well put it up to something resembling a decent ticket price before jumping ship. So, with that in mind, what are the other things I have to tell you? Thanks to everybody. Thanks to Stu. Thanks to Nathan Wood, produced the episode. Jake Crossland logged it. Rob Smouten did the music. And Pete Dobbing is your podcast consultant. So, that's all of that. Thank you for listening. More coming soon. I've got some really, really fun people coming up on the podcast. Some very, very exciting conversations forthcoming, but I won't say any of their names until they're safely in the can. Nearly said my can then. Horrendous. Goodbye to the casual listener and post-amble listener. I'll chat to you in a sec. Bye-bye. I'm losing my mind. That's the main thing I want to talk to you about. I'm losing my mind. Now, not in any way that you need to worry about. Whenever I talk about anxiety on the show, many of you very, very kindly get in touch. But often when you do that, it gives me more emails to reply to. But no, not to naysay or to kind of whatever the word is. People who very kindly get in touch. I am fine, but God damn it, I've been walking around with just, you know, anxiety when it's like sitting there permanently, like a bowling ball in your stomach, like you're just constantly looking over your shoulder, or like, I mean, I normally only ever do this for sort of 2 or 3 days at a time, and then I bounce back to normal, and it's just been there for days and days now, and I'm not quite sure why, and it's got a couple of triggers, and is it because of the therapy more recently, and is that positive? Is that helping? I think it is. I'm sure it is. But normally, you know, the sort of deep background hum of, like, you know, anxiety is when it feels like you've had bad news and then forgotten it, and you're just walking around like you've had bad news, and it's been days and days and days. Anyway, I feel like I'm coping. Who knows? I think I woke up this morning thinking, oh, I'm probably coming out of it now. Nope. Okay. But that is ongoing. So thank you to those of you who said nice things last time. There's no need to write it and check. I'm all right. I'm absolutely fine. Thank you. But part of why I've been so... I'm just mega focused at the moment. I've got so much on that I'm... I remember the heady days of starting my comedy career and really not needing to do much during the day. I was kind of an idiot because I was... Well, you know, I mean, obviously, when I was an open mic, I had to earn money during the day. But by the time I turned pro, there were definitely a few good years of just going, I can do whatever I want. Looking back, whatever I want should probably have been work harder and write more jokes. But... now, Jesus, even when I'm in a bit of an anxious state, I've just got to get on with stuff. Is it parent? It's probably parenthood. And that, in many ways, that's very mentally healthy. I thought that over the whole of the pandemic. The fact that my child or children will run into the bedroom sometimes at 5:45 in the morning, shouting bums in an attempt to make me laugh, which is a lovely way to be woken up. But the sort of the constant presence, the constant requirements, even just the infrastructural requirements, to say nothing of the love, of a family, really keeps you motivated and doing things. And that's really useful. But, God, I sound mad, don't I? That's the thing. I do sound a bit mad at the moment. All I'm trying to say, I think, is that it's a bit of a trying time at the moment. But here's why. I'm doing multiple projects and I think I'm coping with them. And I'm interested in... I think I'm coping with the workload, at least. I'm busy, but, you know, you should be busy. These are your work hard years, as someone once said to me. So you can get rid of this gap, Nathan, while I work out what the fuck I'm dribbling on about. Maybe you should leave that in. Yeah, go on. Leave it in. Leave it in. I don't care. Have I gone mad? I've been... Here's a thing. Let's try and be compassionate to the voice in our head that is behaving all negatively at us. This is such a good little nugget from therapy recently. And I can say this without risk of this being an overshare, but I love this. And for once, you know, you do a bit of therapy and then the session ends and you
even if you have the wherewithal to have made a few notes, how often do you actively engage during the week with a thing that you that you've just learned? How often do you go, oh, that's a good point? How often do you really genuinely reflect on it and make it part of your thinking? This, I absolutely did. I love this. And I'm going to talk about this on... I'm doing this resilience series on LinkedIn. If you're a business person and you're on LinkedIn, jump on LinkedIn. You can find me at Stuart Goldsmith Comedy Insights and connect with me there if you fancy. I've challenged myself to do a short video every day for 30 days. 30 days of resilience is the hashtag to help me kind of, I mean, it's not launching, but, you know, to help me take to market all these resilience things I'm doing. And I will do one of these, one of those little videos about this, but it's specifically compassion to the voice in your head that is naysaying everything and doing you down. Recognizing that the little voice in the back of your head that says, yeah, are you, I mean, with me, it's not like there's a, it's not like there's a voice in the back of my head saying you're a piece of shit. Do you know what I mean? I don't have to cope with that, but it is more that there's this sort of worrisome, troubled kind of, I don't think we can do that. I don't think you can do this. You're not good enough. You won't, you know what I mean? It's like, it's a bit less like a sort of plague night and a bit more like the frog of despair from Red Dwarf, where some aspect of Rimmer's mind is embodied in a swamp full of frogs that are all going useless, useless, useless. It's a bit like that. God, that show was well written. And the point that my therapist was making is that in these, and this is a wide enough point, I feel I can share it with you. I'm sure it'll be appropriate to some of you. Which is that that voice which is going useless is also worthy of compassion. That part of you is a thing that you created in order to get something done. In my case, probably to spur me to action. And I've benefited from that. But just because it was useful once doesn't mean it's useful now. But just because it isn't useful anymore doesn't mean that you've got to sort of hate it and turn it into this awful character that you have to fight off. Instead, have compassion for it and go, oh, they're there, frogs. I love those little useless frogs. They're so funny. Maybe they were funny. Maybe they were quite funny and they massively resonated. But let's hope it was both. You can't just go, Jesus, these fucking frogs. Honestly, part of you is allowed to go, oh, poor little frogs. Poor little frogs. Imagine that. Imagine thinking that the best way for us to cope with things is that you sit around telling me I'm useless. Like, I get where you're coming from, and the more I kind of work to understand why you had to start saying that, the more compassion I can give you. But I just love the idea of compassion rather than a fight, drawing them towards you. I've talked about this before. Years ago, my friend Ninja Chris claimed that there was a mystical, oh, he didn't say mystical, but like a lost martial art, whereby as someone attacked you, you would realign their chi. You would sort of block them and then kind of like you're, instead of a strike, it'd be like a sudden deep tissue massage such that you would realign their chi. So whilst they were fighting you, they became happier and didn't want to fight you anymore. So it's a bit like that, but it's just compassion. So when your little frogs are whispering that you're useless, just try visualising taking one of those little frogs and giving it a little stroke and going, oh, bless you. You think it's necessary to treat me like this. Oh, you poor thing. Because that will help you reframe it. I feel that went somewhere. Nathan, leave in the bit where I... God, I sound like Rogan now. Yeah, Nathan, pull up the fucking thing. Nathan, you may leave in the bit where I was stumped and didn't know what the hell to say, because I feel that went somewhere. And it is up to the listener whether they wish to be so perceptive that they simply, I mean, if you haven't learned by now to fast forward to the end of the postamble to get, just get the last minute of it and work out what I was trying to say, then when will you? Thanks for listening. More stuff coming up next. Some great episodes on the way. Very excited. Speak to you soon.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.